Isn't that nice? You can have a fire. But see, in the summer, I don't need the fire. I can be cozy all day long. And I love the cicadas in the morning. Open the windows and listen to the trucks go by and the cicadas. You need to move the office the other end. And then the katydids at night. Now, it may be because I lived in California. We didn't hear those things. And I associate with going back to Mississippi, where my dad was from, and visiting. And so the sounds of vacation to me, which makes it hard sometimes to do my work. But this is an exciting chapter we're getting into. Daniel chapter 2, we started looking at it last week, and this is enough. Can you click the button? There we go. And there's a lot here to make me stay in my seat and just get excited about the things that are still planned for the future. Now, Daniel chapter 2, the theme of the whole book of Daniel is about God, that God is the Most High God, that He is the Sovereign One, and throughout the book of Daniel, we just keep seeing that. In fact, Reynolds Schauer's commentary in the book is entitled that, The Most High God. And we saw that demonstrated last week in the beginning of our study of chapter 2, as the God of Israel proved His superiority over the entire Babylonian pantheon of gods by revealing to Daniel what those false gods and all their religious adherents could not. Now, just as by way of quick review, you might recall that there was a dilemma the wise men had. King Nebuchadnezzar had a series of dreams, multiple dreams, and they left him very, very troubled. And he anxiously wanted to know the meaning of them. That was very important in their society. They believed you could tell all sorts of things by someone interpreting your dreams for you. However, he did not trust his wise men. And so as a test, to make sure they actually were telling him the truth about the interpretation, he said they must tell him the dream and the interpretation. Well, that's kind of difficult. Because unless someone tells you the dream, how would you know how to interpret it? Because you don't know what it is. You'd be guessing. Now, make it more interesting for them. He said, if you could do this, you'd be very wealthy, you'd receive great honor. But if you don't, I'm going to tear you from limb to limb. I would say there's some incentive there. But they still had a dilemma. How can they do this? They kept asking him. They actually asked him three different times, if please tell us the dream, we'll interpret it for you. And he remained steadfast and firm and actually started getting angry. They even made a claim that says, no great king has ever asked this of his wise men, as if, Nebuchadnezzar, if you're a great king, you won't ask us of this. And he said, it's firm, and he gave an order of execution. They were going to gather all the wise men together, and he was going to execute them. Because as far as he was concerned, he didn't trust them, and he thought they were lying and pulling together deceitfulness. They had finally had admitted to the king that only a god could do what the king was demanding. But even that did not sway the king. The order remained firm. They were all to be executed. Well, the wise men were made up of four groups that are listed in the text as magicians, conjurers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans. And all of them together is a mix of wide-ranging occultic and demonic practices within a matrix of a false religious system that emphasized astrology. They had this idea that the stars, their position, controlled everything. Fate, as you were, including the gods, were controlled by the position of the heavens. They also placed a great importance on dreams and their interpretation, and all those things simply heightened the anxiety the king had to know the meaning of his dream, but for unstated reasons, again, he didn't trust them. He accused them of lying, of conspiring against him. Now, again, that's the reason for the test. Tell me the dream first, then interpret it. But their gods were impotent in the matter, and they admitted it. The king's demand could only be satisfied by some supernatural means. Now, let me remind you quickly, I mentioned this last week, if demons could read minds, they would have known Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and they would have revealed that to their followers. Sometimes I know that comes up. People wonder if Satan can read your mind or demons. No, he observes you very well, and like your mother may be able to read your mind because she just observes you and knows you very well. They can guess what you're thinking, but they can't know actually what's in your mind. Or they would have known. Well, Daniel and his friends were not part of the group that was present. Yet they were wise men, so when the edict went out, Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguards, went looking for Daniel's friends, found them, and told them of the king's decree. The result was Daniel answered calmly and wisely about the reason for the haste, managed to get an audience with the king, and asked for more time, which the king, for unstated reasons, granted him. And that's all Daniel needed for him and his friends to gather together to pray diligently for God's compassion, that they may not be included among the wise men who are going to be destroyed. That's what they wanted. And they labored in prayer, God, be compassionate towards us. Well, God answered those prayers in a night vision and revealed to Daniel both the dream and its interpretation. Daniel, as a result of this, responded in praise to God, and especially for his wisdom and power. Power in God's sovereign hand upon time. He holds time in his hands, both time as a whole and all the events within it. He controls, he directs it. He establishes kingdoms, he establishes kings, and he puts them down. His wisdom that knows even the things that are hidden, those things in darkness. And in his kindness, he reveals some of them to men. Daniel praises God, specifically thanking him for the answer to their prayer of making known the king's matter to him. Well, Daniel went to Arioch first and told him, don't destroy the wise men. He knows the dream. He knows the interpretation. And Arioch then brings Daniel before the king. And of course, as any good sinful person would, tries to claim credit. I found this great guy who's of the Jews. In other words, he's not one of your other wise men. I found him, king. I want some of this blessing too. Give me some of the riches with this. But Daniel gets in front of the king. And Daniel made it very clear. There is a difference between the true God and this pantheon of gods that you've been worshiping since a kid, the Babylonian gods. Verse 27, Daniel chapter 2. Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, or diviners are able to declare it to the king. That's very direct. All your wise men, they have utterly, completely failed. They cannot do this. Now here's the contrast, verse 28. However, there is a God in heaven, or actually in the heavens, who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream, the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. Daniel, contrast to Arioch, is a very humble man. He does not take glory for any of this. He gives all glory to God. It is God that has revealed the dream and its interpretation to him, but only so that Nebuchadnezzar would know what he had been thinking about, pondering in his dreams. God had given the king the dreams concerning what would take place in the future. Now, Daniel, again, a contrast to the other wise men. They, their gods, could not reveal the dream or its interpretation. The God that Daniel served could not only do that, but was also in control of time and the future. So much so, this God even revealed what Nebuchadnezzar was thinking about before he had the dream. That's a detail Nebuchadnezzar didn't even ask about. This is what he had been thinking about. And this is why God had granted the dream. The revelation given to Daniel is proof. His God is the Most High. His God is the Sovereign One. Now, Daniel specifically states that God had given to Nebuchadnezzar a revelation of what is going to take place in the future. And verses 31 through 35 is a description of this dream. Follow along, verse 31. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now the image of this statue is described as great in the sense it's very large. And this is one artist's rendition of what it may have looked like. Of course, putting them in a nice Babylonian dress and headwear and beard. I don't know how you'd grow a beard like that, but I'm not jealous of that one, I'll tell you. Now, this is a reference to it being very bright or shiny, this idea of splendor. And it's large. The various metals would have the appearance of being radiant because they're highly polished. And the total description is perspective being up close to it, so we can start understanding why Nebuchadnezzar would be troubled by this thing. What is it? What's going on? Now, that's just the statue. And then you get the other things that are going on, and it's more troubling. Now, the metals that make up the statue, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, descend in order of value and specific gravity while ascending in order of strength. The head of the statue is gold. It's a very valuable metal. It's dense, weighs 19 times more than water per volume. It's a very soft metal. In fact, it's the most malleable of all metals. I read it can be beaten into sheets so thin that it's transparent. I've never seen one of those sheets beaten that thin, but okay, that may explain what Revelation talks about, streets of gold that are transparent. It is so malleable it can be drawn into a wire, one troy ounce, which isn't very much, into a wire 50 miles long. That's quite a metal. But that's also why they usually mix it with other metals for added strength. If you were wearing a wedding ring and it was pure gold, it just would be constantly getting flat around you. They have to add other metals to give it some strength just so it stays there. Gold also has the property of it's not corrosive. It remains shiny. It doesn't oxidize. It remains shiny and bright and brilliant, and hence part of its value. The breasts and arms are made of silver. That's a metal that's also valuable, though not nearly as much as gold. Admittedly, gold is spiking in crazy manner, but last week I saw gold ran from $1,600 to $1,800 an ounce, while silver was only $37 to $42. Now, silver has a lot of decorative purposes as well. It reflects 95% of light that strikes it, but it does tarnish. Therefore, it's actually it mixes with sulfur oxides, and it gets kind of a dark gray, and so you have to keep polishing it. So it can be very pretty when it's polished, but not so when it's not. It's a little over 10 times more dense than water, about half that of gold. It's the second most malleable metal, and so it also is usually mixed with other metals to produce an alloy, so it has strength for practical use. For example, sterling silver, you often see that when you're going to buy things, is 92.5% silver and 7.5% copper. Now, that's what you wanted to come to church to hear about, right? I don't think so. The belly and the thighs were made of bronze, not brass. Some of your translations use brass. It should be bronze. Brass is a different alloy. Bronze is a mixture of copper and tin. It's one of the oldest alloys known to man. It's resistant to corrosion, though it does develop a green patina, kind of a coating because of the copper in it. Compared to silver, it's inexpensive and much stronger, and though it's not as heavy, it's not as dense. And so it can be easily cast or hammered into shapes desired, and so it's a very useful metal alloy. The legs of the statue are iron. That's the strongest metal mentioned. It's the lightest per volume. It also can be cast or hammered into shapes, and because it is relatively inexpensive, it has a lot of uses. Greatest weakness, it oxidizes easily and rusts. We are usually pretty aware of that. We have things rusting around our houses. The feet are a mixture, iron and clay. Now, don't think of this as iron pieces mixed in with like a clay matrix. The particular word for clay here is the word that's used for potsherds. Think of baked clay or tile. So they're interspersed with each other. The mixture is stronger than just baked clay because it has the iron, but it's weaker than just iron. So it's a mixture. Now, the end of the dream is what's most intriguing. You have this stone, it's uncut, or it's cut out without hands. It's just, there it is. And then it strikes the statue in its feet, and then it crushes and grinds everything so finely the wind blows it away. And then this stone becomes a great mountain that fills the whole earth. Now, in all that imagery, there is a lot for Nebuchadnezzar to consider because of his religious background, and we'll discuss that when we get to verse 45. But at this point, understand, this image would be very troubling to him. Something isn't going well, and he knows that. Now, the king's silence here is evidence that Daniel had accurately told him in a very straightforward manner what he had dreamed. There's no questions, there's no corrections, he's silent. The king continues to listen as Daniel starts to explain, what are all these things about? Now, as we examine the interpretation of the dream, we need to keep in mind that while prophecy, that the prophecy within this has a context, and it does concern, for Daniel, the present Gentile nations and future Gentile nations, but they are within the context of Israel. That's what's in view here. There are other Gentile nations that were greater than these that we're going to be talking about in other parts of the world, but they had no effect on Israel. Biblical prophecy is given from the viewpoint of the priority of God's people and the nation of Israel. That's important to keep in mind as we go through all of this. These other nations, great as they may have been, had no bearing on Israel, therefore they have no importance in biblical prophecy. The empires that are part of Nebuchadnezzar's dream are all those that have a direct bearing on the Gentile domination of Israel following the fall of Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar and extending until the coming of Messiah. That's what these are evolving. Now, the first kingdom, Daniel explains, starting in verse 36. This was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them to your hand, and he has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. The interpretation begins with this explanation of the head, which is Nebuchadnezzar as representative of the Babylonian Empire. And certainly starting with him, because he is the king that conquers Jerusalem. Now, Daniel is pointed that Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, his power, his strength, his glory, all came to him as a gift from the God of the heavens. That is the second or third time that Daniel has used that title. Same title used in verse 28. The king didn't get these things because of himself or his father or anything special about them. It came as a gift from the true God. It didn't get it from his gods, the ones that he had been worshipped in paganism. This is the God that controls the heavens, not the one controlled by the heavens. That's very different. The sovereign one. Daniel is not hesitant to point out the superiority of the true God, even though Daniel is a captured Jew speaking to the king that captured him. That's not necessarily a good position to be in, but Daniel's not hesitant because he still knows who his God is. Now, some liberal commentators have questioned Daniel calling Nebuchadnezzar king of kings, yet that's actually what he was. He had conquered other kingdoms and put his own puppet kings there. Jehoiakim, currently in Jerusalem, is his puppet king. He is a king of kings. Not only that, Ezekiel 26:7 used the same title for him. And in the same period, the Persian king, Ariyarmanah, 610 to 580 B.C., was also used the same title. It always amazes me. You read these commentaries, and these liberal guys don't seem to look what's even in the text. They got to make things up. I always understood that because in trying to get your doctorate, you have to come up with something new. So they got to create something. It's in the text. Look it up. This is a proper title for him. Some commentators also speak against the breadth of his power described in verse 38. Why? Well, Nebuchadnezzar did not rule over everything on earth. He did not control the birds and the beasts. Now, it could be just hyperbole, exaggerating the king's power to make the point of his kingdom's priority. But if we keep in mind biblical prophecy centered on Israel, what did it have control over? Everything related to Israel. And that's where it is coming from. In regards to the birds and the beasts, it doesn't say he controlled them. It said he ruled over them. That parallels the dominion mandate given to us in Genesis 1:28. It's also possible, and I think it's certainly got to be part of the mix in understanding what Daniel is saying and how Nebuchadnezzar would take this, is it parallels the ceremonies that took place in Babylon during the new year. And during that time, the Babylonian epic of creation would be recounted, which includes how their god, Marduk, gave all these specific powers to the king. Daniel saying this now sets this exactly in contrast to that. You think Marduk gave you these things? No. This came from a different god. That's where rule and authority came from, King Nebuchadnezzar. Not from what you get recounted every year in these ceremonies that take place at New Year's. There is a different God. He is the powerful one. That's where these things come from. Now, the head of gold is a fitting analogy for Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian empire. First, it's a singular head, and Nebuchadnezzar ruled autocratically according to his own whims. Even the laws were according to whatever he decreed without recourse, even if he changed his mind. The kingdoms that would follow would not have such singular authority. Gold was also appropriate because Babylon was filled with gold. Herodotus, visiting the city some 90 years later, is astonished at the amount of gold there. It was even used as building material, covering the walls of buildings and are being overlaid with it, walls and buildings. It's all over the place. Perhaps that's one reason why Nebuchadnezzar didn't bother to take off all the gold when he first captured Jerusalem. Remember, he captured it three times. 605 B.C. is when Daniel is captured. Then in 586, he captures it again in Jehoiakim's rebellion. That's when Ezekiel is taken to captivity, and that's when he takes all the gold out of the temple. Before then, he only took a few things. In addition, we find that gold was important in the Babylonian kingdom because their god, Marduk, their chief god, one of his titles was the god of gold. So the head is gold. The next kingdom, the second and thirds, are going to follow, are only very briefly mentioned here. They're going to be covered more in Daniel 7 and 8. Verse 39, "And after you there will rise another kingdom inferior to you, and then a third kingdom of bronze which will rule over all the earth." So just hardly anything said about them. Again, we'll get more to them. Daniel 7 and 8 is going to talk about them specifically. Now, a brief description, but Daniel is specific. The second kingdom is inferior to Babylon. This is a kingdom which represented the silver chest and arms. That's Medo-Persia. It conquered Babylon in 539 B.C. Now, this empire actually controlled a larger territory, but because it is a partnership between two different peoples, there was not a centralized power. Their king had to go by laws, and there was vying for power within it. It wasn't centralized, it wasn't as organized as Babylon was, and therefore it was inferior from that standpoint. The Medo-Persian Empire was characterized by silver. Its economic system was based on it. It was a standard of value and the medium of exchange. Daniel is specific when he gets to the third kingdom that it is characterized by bronze and would rule over all the earth. Again, keep in mind the prophetic view is focused on who controls the territory of Israel. No kingdom yet has yet ruled over every place on earth. There will be a kingdom that will do that, but that's to come. This third kingdom is Greece. It was characterized by bronze, which they used extensively for their military equipment, far superior to the things that have been used by other peoples, and that's one reason they were able to conquer so rapidly, Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great conquered a huge territory. He defeated Persia in 331 B.C. and went on to conquer all the area that Babylon controlled and all of Persia controlled, and he had a whole lot of the West as well. From a Middle East standpoint, that was the known earth. However, Alexander died at a young age, and his four generals split the kingdom among them, with two of the dynasties becoming dominant, the Ptolemies and Seleucids, that's Egypt and Syria. And they battled for centuries over what we now call the Middle East, which includes the land of Israel. The fourth kingdom is given much more attention, Daniel 2, verse 40. "Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush to break all these in pieces. And in that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seat of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery." Now, what's all that? Well, Rome. Rome was characterized by iron, especially its weaponry. Its armies were crushing armies. They would grind up their opposition. Iron was far superior militarily. It was of higher strength and lighter in weight than bronze. Roman history is a succession of conquering empires around them, other kingdoms, both east and west. Just dealing with those going east of Rome, Greece defeated in 149 BC. Macedonia was annexed in 146 BC. Syria became a Roman province in 64 BC, with Jerusalem captured and Palestine annexed in 63 BC. Egypt is annexed in 30 BC. Now, Rome does not expand as far as Alexander had gone to the east, but it did control all the Mediterranean areas, and thus Rome controlled both the east and the west, because Rome also went out as far as Britain. Now, the Roman Empire consolidated a large territory into one empire, but it was also plagued with revolts and civil wars. Just read through its history, even the timeline. It's a constant thing that's coming up. Many of these were simply attempts by those in power to gain it for themselves, but some of it was fueled by this fact they had many nations conquered under one empire, and they didn't want to mix together. And they would faction, and they would vie for strength and power and independence. Even among those people that were of mixed ancestry, they were of two different nations that had married, they had children, they didn't even mix. They would choose one or the other, and they would still be fighting and intrigue and seeking of independence. So there was a strength of iron in the empire itself, but the many parts that made it up didn't stick together well. The Roman Empire split into two major parts in 395 AD, after the death of Theodosius I, into a Western and Eastern Empire. And ancient Rome isn't so much conquerors, it just falls apart piece by piece. As you'd expect, something was a mixed things like this, iron and clay, it just falls apart one piece at a time. And yet we find historically that those pieces still try and forge some sort of unity together, some sort of ability to work together and do things together. That is something that will continue even to the time of the final kingdom. That's what's described there in verses 44 and 45. Now in the past, from our perspective, we're looking back, Daniel had been looking forward. That was done in the Roman Empire itself as it got later after the time of Christ. The rise of the Roman Catholic Church in the 600s, and it became a political force, and then the Holy Roman Empire also tried to do the same thing. The pieces that were once Rome still tried to do things together. The Holy Roman Empire was trying to force some of this together, but it didn't stick too well together, did it? There's always a vying and a faction and a fighting. But they still would try to make treaties. Even in the present, that's being done. Isn't that the European common market? In the future, it could be the common market. It could be some other entity. We don't know. But it's going to try and accomplish the same basic goals. Whatever form it takes, this union of 10 nations, these 10 toes, and later we're going to find 10 horns later in Daniel, it's going to have a strong influence on the nation of Israel. Because that's where the center always is in biblical prophecy. So Rome hasn't really disappeared, it's just in a different form. And it keeps trying to resurrect itself. But there's a final kingdom, and this one is the most intriguing. Verse 44. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it itself will endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron and the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. This future kingdom is going to arise while the final form of the Roman kingdom is still active. It's while these kings are there that it arises. And its source is the God of the heavens. That's the third time Daniel used that title to distinguish Nebuchadnezzar. This is a different God. It's something different than the Babylonian pantheon of gods, which were controlled by the heavens. This future kingdom is further distinguished from all the previous ones. It will never be destroyed. It will not be succeeded by another people. It will crush permanently the previous kingdoms, and it is going to endure forever. The description of the dream would have made these points even more clear to Nebuchadnezzar, that this is all being done by a God far superior than any God he'd ever heard about before. Daniel reinforces that in verse 45. The chief god of the Babylonians was named Marduk, and they believed that he came from a sacred mountain referred to as the Mountain of the Lands. Their temples were actually built to resemble mountains. That's why they would have that shape. They also believed that Marduk was in control of the wind. They called him Lord of the Wind. And finally, the Babylonians thought of the earth itself as a great mountain, which they called Mountain House. Now, with those things in mind, it becomes clear Nebuchadnezzar understood the divine nature of what is being portrayed. There's a stone that is cut out without hands. It's a divine stone. Portraying Marduk came from a mountain. Here's a stone that comes from where? But it's a divine one. They thought Marduk came from the mountain itself. This stone then smashes in the feet of the statue. It causes it to collapse, and it crushes the pieces and grinds it so fine, the wind carries it away. That's a divine judgment by a great God establishing his kingdom on earth. Gentile dominance will end. And then this same stone that becomes a mountain fills the whole earth. A divine kingdom physically set up on earth. Daniel again makes it clear that all this is by a different God than those who have been worshipped by Nebuchadnezzar. This is, and he uses a different phrase here, the great God. The great God. The one who has made known to him what would take place in the future. None of his gods, this whole pantheon of gods, could do that. Daniel concludes saying the dream is true, its interpretation is trustworthy. And Nebuchadnezzar accepted it as such because he knew only a God with power beyond any of his religious experience, anything he even heard about in his religious system, could make known both the dream and the interpretation. And Daniel's God had done just that. Well, King Nebuchadnezzar kept his word. He had promised riches and honor. Verse 46 through 49 tell us about that. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, did homage to Daniel, and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. He made him ruler of the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made requests of the kings, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Now, Nebuchadnezzar does homage, or some of your translations may say worship, of Daniel. This is not treating Daniel as a god. It is rather common in their society, it's treating him as a representative of the God that had given him the revelation. That's made even more clear in verse 47, where he specifically states that Daniel's God, not Daniel himself, Daniel's God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings, revealer of mysteries. He recognized the difference. It's not Daniel. It's the God that Daniel serves. So this homage was in deference to that God. It's acknowledgement that is the true God. Now, his acknowledgement here doesn't mean that he is going to become a follower of this true God, at least not yet. We've got to go a couple more chapters before he's humble enough to do that. But it does bring him to a place of recognition. There is a God greater than he had ever considered before. He at least has come to that point. But he's going to remain blinded by his own religious system and pride until a future time when God is going to deal with him personally. Now, Nebuchadnezzar keeps his word. He rewards Daniel with riches and honor and a key position in his government. The Babylonian Empire was separated into provinces. Daniel is made ruler over the immediate province of Babylon itself. That is an extremely important position. He is also made the chief prefect over all the wise men. In other words, he's in charge of them too. Now, remember, this is a young man. And he's been elevated to this position while so young. Why? Because the king recognizes there's a different God in working with him. And that's better than anything he's had before. Daniel is going to be only accountable to the king. That's where his accountability goes. Daniel, in turn, is quick, and at his request, the king appoints Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Because they had labored together with him in prayer. They had been with him from the beginning. They had also diligently followed God to the best of their ability. And they're appointed to administer the province of Babylon over which Daniel is ruler. So while Daniel's in the king's court, they're carrying out all the duties of it. So you have the king, and then Daniel, and then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego right under them. Now later we're going to see this is going to be the cause of a lot of jealousy among those who used to have power. But that's quite an elevation. From captured slave, and then 3 years later, you're in charge of a whole province accountable only to the king, with your friends serving directly under you. Now, there are several important lessons for us in recounting these historical events. The first is a repeat from the lesson from chapter 1, and that's this. Those who follow God must put him first in everything and leave the results in God's hands. That's the first lesson. Daniel's friends, they did that in chapter 1 in regards to striving not to be defiled by the king's meat. They did it here because they placed their lives completely in the Lord's hands because their only solution to their dilemma was prayer, wasn't it? We're going to leave this up to God. In both these cases, the Lord graciously granted the request and then eventually elevated them to important positions. Those who are faithful in little things are the ones who prove to be faithful in great things. Those are the ones that God will elevate, whatever those things may be. Second, and I think more importantly, is this lesson. The God of the Bible, he is the Most High. He is the great God. He is the sovereign one. There is no other. And we can trust him for our future even when it looks bleak. Their future didn't look too good for a while there, did it? They were under the king's edict of execution. This was true on a personal level. It is true on a national level. We will see that it is God that holds the nations in his hands, and he has a definite plan for them. He knows what he's going to do with them. It was true then. It is still true today. We live in a time of turmoil in our own land. And you don't even have to be a student of American history to know that we are a rapidly declining nation. In all sorts of ways. We have thought of ourselves as powerful, but let's face it, even our economics and our military are on their way out if we continue as we are currently. Because we won't be able to afford it. Now, that's not a nice time to live in, is it? People like to live when the nation's ascending, and I'm part of this. No one likes to be when it's on the decline, the used-to-be's. If you know our history, American history, and you know God's grace, mercy, and grace upon this nation, you're even more aware of all that has already been lost. And it's a huge amount. And it's easy to fall into despair when we see continually this stuff going on and the escalating failure of national, state, and local leaders of all types. That's not just political or governmental, but in education, societal leaders in different groups, media leaders, and religious leaders. And the religious leaders are the worst of all. I will put it this way. The reason the United States is in the shape it is now is because the failure of the church from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. That's why we're where we are. The church ceased to be the church, and it's still running rapidly the other way. We've become ashamed of the name of Christ. Some of you may be aware that the Campus Crusade for Christ has changed its name because they're embarrassed of the name Christ. Now it's called CRU, C-R-U, short for Crusade. What does that say about us when you have an evangelical mission organization that says, I'm afraid to name the name of Christ? Who are they calling them to? This is the church. The religious leaders bear much of the responsibility because they have not led. They're going the other direction. They have rejected sound doctrine from God's word, and they become ear ticklers for the sake of popularity and finances. That's all around us. Now, Daniel was in a worse position than us, wasn't he? We're not nearly that bad yet. But did Daniel despair? Not at all. And neither should we. No matter how much we don't like what goes on, we have no reason to despair. Why? Remember, Daniel was a Jewish boy who had been captured standing before the conquering king. And what was he like? He was strong, he was pointed, and he didn't back down for one reason. He knew his God. And his God was still in control. His God still knew what he was doing. Because this is not about our personal circumstances. It's not about our nation. It's not about our personal kingdom, our house, our wealth, our ease of life. It's not about America. It is about the Almighty God, who is the creator of all things and his glory. And he is the one that will judge all people with equity and righteousness. It's about you walking in righteousness and in integrity with this God and bringing glory to him in all circumstances. That's what your existence is about. Period. Now, on the personal front, that means there's several things we need to be. One, we need to learn to be content. Philippians 4, 11 through 13, Paul talked about that. He learned to be content. We need to learn the same. Discontent is a way for the devil to get in and distract us and push us away from what we're here for. Learn to be content, even as Paul did. Second, we need to be a people who are prayerful. When the situation was made known to Daniel, what did he do? Got his friends together, they went and prayed. We're going to put this in God's hands and leave it in God's hands. We need to be a people who will seek God out in order to deal with unreasonable demands that were placed upon us, just like Daniel and his friends did. We need to be those who also will stand up and do what is right, even if it does place us at risk, as we will see in the weeks ahead in Daniel 3 and 6. We need to follow that example. Are we willing to do that? Are we willing to, as there's a song, dare to be a Daniel? Dare to stand alone? Are we willing to do that and follow the example? We need to recognize and live according to the reality that the purpose of our existence is to glorify God by becoming like the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what your salvation is about. We don't belong to ourselves. We're God's slaves, and we must leave the future and all the consequences of doing what is right in his hands and be satisfied with that. Now, in regards to our nation, we ought to work hard to uphold and establish righteousness in our land. That's simply the right thing to do. Even when we face a reality that we could be on the losing side, you do understand that. We may be on the losing side, and America is going to decline further. And while no soldier likes to be either the rear guard or to fight what seems to be a futile effort, if that is what the commander asks of us, then it is our glory in doing what he asks, whatever the task may be. Where is our sake of personal honor in following our commander? So yes, we work to uphold righteousness, knowing that our nation may fall apart. But the USA is eventually going to be replaced, isn't it? It eventually is going to become like all other nations in hating God and coming under his judgment, and he will destroy it. Four nations, it says, being described and ground up, and the wind blew it away. Those were mighty empires. Do we think we're any different because we're Americans? I don't think so. There will be a day that God's judgment will come upon this nation, and it will be destroyed, it will be ground up, and it will blow away. Should that cause us despair? No. Why? A simple reason. What is going to replace it? Christ is going to replace it. And our citizenship is in heaven, from whence we look for the Savior. He shall return. He shall establish his kingdom. And if you're part of his kingdom, you're part of that. So, do away with this. I'm ready for the new one. But until God brings that, I'm going to do what my Savior, my commander, says to do as a faithful soldier and fight for his righteousness no matter where I am, no matter what the circumstances, no matter how futile it may seem. We do what we do because we pursue righteousness. Even if we are slandered in the process, and you will be. Jesus already told us that, didn't he? Blessed are you when men shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Expect it. We do what we do because we serve our Creator. We are His slaves. If you will live in the reality of that truth, then you will be like Daniel and his friends, glorifying the Lord by doing what is right in the present and having His peace, regardless of circumstances, knowing your God holds everything, time itself, and the future in His hands. He knows what He wants from your life, and He will use you accordingly, appropriately. You will fulfill your purpose of existence in glorifying Him. Father, we are grateful because of what you have told us is true. And though, admittedly, some of it is not comfortable, we admit we like ease of life.